All right, this is Gary Parrish from CBS Sports. It's now Monday, November 23rd. This is, of course, the Eye on College Basketball podcast, and I'm joined today by Sam Bassini and Matt Norlander, who is back from a brief hiatus from the podcast because he had to become a father. Matt Norlander, you are speaking to us today for the first time publicly as a father of a young boy. How much have you noticed your life change already?
You know, there hasn't been that much change, Gary. I got to be honest. Things are pretty smooth. They're pretty normal. I'm able to effectively get my work done. And listen, my goals of fatherhood are basically to raise a child that brings production, happiness, and joy to the world and helps make the world a better place, and proving you wrong in the process that I can't do my job effectively and that this thing won't entirely change my day-to-day. No, of course, obviously, he's changed a lot. And he's actually right next to me as we're recording this podcast.
I'm not going to give you tips every single week on how to be a father, because honestly, I don't even know that I'm that great or even good of a father. But I do. Here's one tip I will offer free of charge. Probably not ideal to do podcasts with a baby next to you.
Hey, listen, the wife is getting some sleep. He's chilled out. He's passed out right now. He's loving it. All right. I do want to say thank you for giving me the shout out on the podcast. It was funny because this thing, he came 10 days early. And so it was just funny on the one 2 weeks ago, we were joking about I might miss the next one. Didn't think there was any shot. I ended up missing it. And so like Wednesday night, chilling in the hospital, finally listened to the podcast. And so I did listen.
Thank you. Shout out.
Appreciate that.
And are you not worried that talking right next to a baby is going to be the actual thing that wakes the baby up?
No, because listen, here's the other weird thing, and I promise I will not gab about my child for this entire podcast, but when we were in the hospital, the nurses were like, listen, you want to have, not at nighttime, but during the day when he's passed out, you want normal noise next to him so that he's not sleeping in an environment where he has to be silent all the time. So they were like closing doors without a care, and he was sleeping through it, so this is actually pretty good for him. So so he's loving it, man. It's been crazy. The one thing I do want to say is, so we ended up having, you, so funny, you were mentioning about the C-section deal, and there's plenty of stuff that I could share for the podcast, but I'll share it with you guys in person at another time, because there's some funny stuff and some crazy stuff that went down. But she had the C-section unplanned because this guy was just, he was a little too twisted under there, and they didn't want to keep going after about 3 hours of pushing. I cannot tell you, when he actually like arrived, it wasn't like this angels were in the room, happiness, oh my God, my life has new meaning. It was just beyond surreal.
Oh, sure.
For this being, like, because I'm on the other side of the curtain. It wasn't like a traditional birth. So they take him out and they, you know, they clean him off. They make sure, you know, he's crying. The doctor said when he came out, gave the time of day, 3:46. And then he just kind of had these like stilted loud cries. And it was almost like I wasn't even in the room when that was happening. I think that is one of the most unpredictable moments of any person's life, is you just don't know how you're going to feel when the child arrives. And so it was crazy, bizarre, and surreal for him to actually be in existence and crying and on the table. And like, it was so awesome, but it was also really weird and a blur like an hour after that.
No, it's a weird experience. So I have two boys, and they were both delivered C-section. And so hold on, were you near your wife's head or feet?
Yes. I will say yes. I was near the head, and in fact, they made me sit there, which I would have anyway. And I never, my eyes never wandered, like, because he came out, and then they're like, "All right, Dad, you want to hold him?" Because my wife can't hold him.
So you didn't see them actually pull the baby out?
No.
Oh wow! See,
not.
I've seen that.
No, I did not see that.
There is nothing weird.
I didn't want to see that.
It like they like, because it's a pretty quick process, right? It's a pretty.
Yeah, he was out. Like, I sat down. So they have to prep her. They bring me in. I sat down. And basically, from me sitting down to him being out of her was 3 minutes tops.
Yeah.
And then it was like 25 minutes for them to put her back together.
Right. So yeah, you think you have these ideas of what childbirth is. And it's right. It's like this long process where you're sitting there and you're going push and put. And it's like you don't exactly know when it's coming. It could be 20 minutes. It could be 3 hours. And yet the C-section, that was the most startling thing for me, is that they lie you down and they cut your wife open and they pull a baby out. I mean, it's like crazy. It is. I actually saw it. So, yeah, it's probably why it is weird to watch them like cut your wife and pull a baby. They just pull a baby. It is exactly what you would think it would look like. They pull a baby right out of your wife's stomach, which is just bananas.
It was wild, man. And so much more. I'll tell you guys another time, but it was cool. Glad we're back in the swing of things. And it was bad for you guys, but it was kind of cool for me that he came as the 24-hour marathon. He was born last Monday. So we're actually almost at it. He's almost exactly a week old as we're recording this. And so I was able to watch patches of basketball and kind of keep up. And we've had obviously so much happen since last Monday and Tuesday and Wednesday, but you know, being in the hospital, and I only got ESPN and ESPN2, so anything else I wasn't able to watch. But in keeping up with that, it's been a pretty interesting first week. I know there's like 1,000 directions we can go here, and I'll let GP kind of decide. But there've definitely been from performances. Like, you know, Denzel Valentine's been awesome, and Pirtle's been terrific, and Buddy Hield's been awesome, to a lot of unexpected losses, even since you guys had the podcast. So, you know, where do you guys want to launch off here?
Well, let's start with what I think's among the biggest surprises, and I think undeniably the most impressive starts to the season, and that's with Miami. I think Sam watched Miami play last night as well as I did. I've watched them now play twice on national television. And they got a blowout win over Utah. The Butler game, I think, ended up being they won by 10 or something. But like, they were up big early, and then the officials got involved, and the score tightened up a little bit. But they were never, I don't think, in any real danger of actually losing that game. Every time Butler made a run, they'd make a shot and extend the lead back. They look awesome. I mean, they look really, really good. Like the type of team that you think should be. Definitely could be a factor at the top of the ACC. Sam, what did you make of what you've seen from Miami?
Yeah, I've now gotten a chance to watch them 4 times. I watched all 3 of their games in Puerto Rico, and then watched the Louisiana Lafayette game, because Lafayette is the Sun Belt favorite this year as well, and they have a win over those guys. It's been really impressive. They're an incredibly athletic team. They're probably one of the 10 or so most athletic teams in the country. They have 2 really good two-way wings in Sheldon McClellan and Davon Reed, who can really get after it defensively and can knock down shots. They have Tonya Jaquiri, who has taken a massive leap, both offensively and defensively. Like, he was killing pick and rolls defensively. He was making shots off of post moves against Jakob Pertl, which isn't easy to do if you ask anyone in the Pac-12. It's really, really impressive to see what he's done. And then Angel Rodriguez is playing within himself, which is something that they'll need throughout the rest of the year, and something I don't know that will happen throughout the rest of the year. But he's been really good. I mean, this entire team is rolling right now, and I think it's impossible to say anyone's had a better week than right. Jim Larrañaga, given the fact that they just got 2 top 30-ish recruits in last week. They got 2 top 30-ish recruits in last week, and then won the Puerto Rico title this week. So it's just been a great, great week for Miami.
Yeah, they're the only team in the country at this moment that has 2 wins over preseason top 25 teams. Now, some of that's just schedules. Like, you know, most people haven't even played 2 top 25 teams. But, they've got 2 resume wins in their back pocket. And, you know, it's November 23rd. So when you combine, you know, obvious athleticism, experience, and then I think, I don't think you guys would disagree with this, one of the better coaches in college basketball. You know, this is, you know, it looks like they've got a fun team there.
The Larrañaga, we kind of touched on this in previous years when Miami was good a couple years ago. That was not a hire that was lauded by almost anyone, just because of his age, and Mason had kind of, you know, just kind of leveled out a little bit after the big Final Four run. We're coming up on the 10-year anniversary of that. But this is clearly, I mean, he's got a really solid staff, and it has clearly turned out to be the kind of hire that really ended up being successful. I mean, we'll see what happens this year. But in general, with what Larrañaga has done to an extent in previous years, now we get the huge commitments going forward, and we see a lot of what this team is this year. It just, you know, we can, in the media, we can admit we're wrong sometimes. And I don't think people were killing Miami for the hire.
Right.
I just think people thought, why would you hire Jim Larrañaga, who's approaching 60 years old, when at the time there were certainly a number of decent candidates that were, you know, 50 and under. For them, it's worked out well.
You know what the common opinion was? Clearly wrong, but the common opinion felt a little bit like Oliver Purnell going to Chicago. You know, like a guy getting older and he's like, you know what, I'm going to take some money and just go retire in Chicago, you know, have some nice, you know, have nice meals and drink. Well, that's what people thought about Oliver. Like, yeah, obviously you're not leaving Clemson for a better job, but it's like, you're getting a big contract and you get to go ride it out in one of the great American cities. People were making about Larinaga, he's an old man going to retire in South Florida. You know,
Del Boca like, Vista, yeah.
Yeah, like yeah. But, you know, I went down there a couple years ago and spent time with him and his wife. Like, him and his wife, I went to lunch the day after they had beaten a North Carolina team. This is the year that they had Shane Larkin and they won the ACC. And just some things I think everybody knows it now, but at the time when Miami hired him, you know, he's from Cuban American. He's the son of Cuban Americans. Like, you know, Miami is a place that makes sense for him. And in fact, I believe the story, I just can't remember the details, but he had met some prominent Miami boosters at like some fantasy camp or something. And that's how he got involved on some mm-hmm. level with the job is, you know, they were Cuban Americans and he was like, you know, this is, you know, you're my people. And they just hit it off. And so when the job opened, his name got bounced around and then, you know, it made sense for him. I think he had had a little bit of, I don't want to say a falling out, but maybe he and his administration at George Mason weren't on the same page anymore. And so, you know, it was a hire that, like you said, nobody ripped, but it didn't make a lot of sense on the surface. And it has exceeded everybody's expectations. They won an ACC title. And I'm not ready to predict that they're going to do it another one this year, but mm-hmm. They got a team that's capable. It looks like, you know, as strong as the ACC is, they've got a team that I think can play with just about anybody.
Okay, so I'll pivot this to Sam, but yeah, so ACC right now, Miami's undefeated. Here's the somewhat surprising thing. Again, it's generally the schedule is part of this, but top three teams in the ACC this year going in, who were they? They were Carolina, then probably Virginia, then probably Duke. Guess what? All those teams have a loss, mm-hmm. while Miami looks great. They're undefeated. Louisville has looked solid. Notre Dame and Pittsburgh haven't lost yet. Pittsburgh only has two games on the schedule due to that disaster that happened in Japan with the floor that they couldn't even finish the game. Syracuse still undefeated as well. Again, we're still early, and we got huge Thanksgiving week of games ahead of us. But it is something that I saw last night and kind of just looking around, I was like, huh, it's just funny how sometimes these things work out. That Virginia, Duke, Carolina, you know, they'll probably all still be solid.
Well, I think the context matters a little bit. Like
Carolina didn't have Paige.
Yeah, you know. Carolina didn't have Paige and played a true road game. Virginia played a true road game and Duke had to play Kentucky. So like, you know, probably anybody's going to lose that game. So
Duke's also won a few really good games.
Right. Right. So I'm not that concerned about any of them, although Duke, like when you lose as much as Duke lost, you know, four starters from the national championship team, you really need your impactful freshmen to perform. And so far, and I know you've seen him, Sam, multiple times, Brandon Ingram doesn't look great. He has not made an impact at all. He's just not playing very well.
Yeah, I mean, he's shooting like 36% right now. He's really struggling offensively. It seems like he's still struggling to adjust to just the physicality of the game. On this level, he's still kind of an impact player just due to his length and due to his athleticism. Like he's still averaging like 10.6 points per game, but he hasn't been the top five freshman, potential top five pick that, you know, you expect to see from a guy that has his reputation. Like I talked to a scout last week who said that he thinks by the end of the year, Ingram has as good a chance as anyone to be a number one pick in the entire draft. So like it's weird that he hasn't gotten there yet, but it's still surprising as well, I would say, given what his pedigree is.
Right.
I mean, let me just hop in here. Like I just don't see, I've already seen enough from Ben Simmons and Brandon Ingram where like, let's not, and people just listen, the season is long, so they get ahead of themselves. There's just no way you could ever consider Brandon Ingram to be a pick over Ben Simmons. Like the Simmons has come out of the gate, and I know that he has played. Like Duke's schedule is so much harder than LSU's.
Right.
And actually, by the end of tonight on Monday, the game I'm actually most looking forward to is Simmons against Ellinson.
That's right.
It's LSU's only decent. It's their only decent non-conference game. Okay. And so I get that Simmons has played patsies, and that's. But like, you just watch him play. Like,
he looks great.
He looks great. He is. And this is a lot of what he's doing now is what we saw. It's so funny. Like, we'll see these guys on the AAU trail, and you just never know, like, what you're kind of get, like, a year removed when they get to be college freshmen, because sometimes their bodies will grow or their games might change a little bit. Obviously, the talent's so much better at the college level. But Simmons is basically just a continuation of what we saw in the summer of 2014. He just – it's incredible. I'm almost at a point wondering where Simmons and Denzel Valentine, who has one triple-double in his other two games, are he came really close, and if they weren't blowouts, he probably would have had him. I'm wondering if Simmons and Denzel Valentine might be and I won't forget about Collinsworth. We'll be in a kind of a head-to-head race this season. This could be sort of a year of the triple-double in college basketball, because all three of those players have games that kind of endear them to that kind of play.
Don't forget Chris about Dunn, your boy too. Chris Dunn. That's exactly what I was going to say.
Oh, Sam, there we go. Yeah. Absolutely. Sam, no doubt about it.
Sam, let me ask you this. And because, you know, Norlander thinks that Simmons is probably looking like the number one pick in the draft at this point. Keep in mind, at this point last year, most people thought it was Okafor. So, like, this stuff
can
change.
Yeah, no, it's so early.
So early, right. But I do get the sense from talking to NBA people that most of them, while recognizing they don't have to pick till June, but if they had to pick today, Simmons is also that guy. Are you of the opinion now? Like, if you had to update a mock draft today, would you have Simmons at the top, or would you?
I would have Simmons at the top, but I'll push back a little bit. I'll say that Simmons is already 19. He'll be 20 before he plays his first NBA game. He's 15 or 16 months older than Brandon Ingram. And his physical attributes are good, not great. I mean, if by that I mean his body, his length, everything like that. He's like 6'9 with a 6'11 wingspan. So there are plenty of pratfalls that could befall Ben Simmons. Also, his game so far, he's taken 22 of his 24 shots at the rim, has not really done much in the half court at all. I think that, like I said, he's rarely taken a jump shot, rarely needed to really do anything outside of the paint. So the jury is still very much out on Ben Simmons, I will say. I'm not saying that he hasn't been great, because he has been great, but we're still learning about what he is as a basketball player, I would say.
Yeah, we're going to, the same way with Karl Anthony Towns and any of these guys, but I sort of like the idea that he's gotten 22 of 24 buckets at the rim. Like, that means he just gets to the rim. And the competition's been terrible.
You're not going to be able to do that against NBA competition. Like, you're going to be able to do that against Kennesaw State and South Alabama. There's nobody in the world outside of LeBron James who can get to the rim that much.
No. I got you. But, like, yeah, I mean, we're still, like, in November of his freshman year. Right. I have high expectations for the kid. Like, I've forever thought he was great. And like, what
you were the one that discovered him, GPA, right?
I discovered Scow, and I discovered Mickey Mitchell. Remember when I discovered Mickey Mitchell?
Yes, I
want to ask about this one?
I was in one of those weird, like 16 and under, like it's one of those for people who don't know the Peach Jam in North Augusta. The 17 and unders play in the morning, and then they play at night, and in between the 16 and unders play. And sometimes the coaches are in there for the 16 and unders, but that's typically when a rider might go get lunch, right? And maybe go get a run in or something. So, but I don't remember who I was talking. You get in these conversations with coaches, and you just end up sitting in a gym. You don't even know who's on the court, but you're in the middle of a conversation about something. So a 16 and under game starts, but you don't have any idea what's going on in it. Or at least that's the case for me. I'm not a recruiting analyst. So, I'm watching this team. I guess they were from Texas, and this white kid is just balling out, man. He's just like, I'm like, man, this kid is really good. And whatever coach I was talking to didn't know who he was either. And I text like somebody, like maybe it was Borzello or Evan Daniels, like one of the recruiting guys. I'm like, yo, man, have you seen this white kid from Texas? I think his name's Mickey Mitchell. I'm like, he's really good. And they were like, yeah, he's like top three in the country. I was like, okay, that makes sense then. And of course, he fell off after
he
that.
He did, yeah.
He tore his knees up.
Yeah. But so I I didn't actually.
The joke is that every summer there's some sort of consensus top 10 prospect that Parrish hasn't seen in person yet, and then he walks into a gym and it's packed, and he's like, "Wait, hold on a second. Does everyone see what I see right now?"
Like, yeah, I'm
like, he saw Kelly like 2 years ago. I was at the opposite end of the gym, and I walk in. I see him walk into the gym, and he's there for maybe like 10 minutes. And it's like it's a group chat with a group text with me, Borzello, Goodman, Parrish, and I don't know where Parrish goes. I just discovered Kelly Oubre.
That's the thing. Sure. I go into a 16 and under game where I'm completely unfamiliar with prospects, and I discover somebody like Marvin Bagley. I discovered him this summer too.
Seriously. all right. So,
by the way, let me finish.
Listen, there he is, got the baby.
There he is. I got him. Don't worry. I got him.
Let me just note really quickly. Like, I'm not down on Ben Simmons by any means.
Sounds like he's been very good.
But I think that right now he would be the number one overall pick right now. But I just think that the jury is still very much out, and we're kind of anointing him a little bit early.
What about if not Simmons? Let's just touch freshman real quick, guys. Swanigan's been amazing. What other first year players through, like, Swanigan? I think has played above expectation, but I haven't seen all the games, and I wasn't able to track every day last week. So has anyone else definitely immediately popped?
Jamal Murray.
I was gonna say Jamal Murray.
Yeah. I mean, Jamal Murray's been really good.
Scal's been good.
He's had moments. He's been up and down a little bit, but he's still averaging, 14 points, 4 rebounds a game. I think this is, he's sort of an interesting prospect because Cal typically likes his big to be big, right? He likes his bigs to be big. Like, Carl Anthony Towns plays on the perimeter. No, not at Kentucky. Go get down there and score in the paint. But like, Scott,
can't do that.
No, that's the thing. I think Cal's going to get to a point where he's just going to say, all right, we're going to take advantage of the kid's talent and let him float, as we're not going to turn him into a double digit rebounder. But that's at least among the issues right now. He isn't a around the rim, go grab balls, bang with people type of kid. But Cal, would, and that's the type of 7-footer that Cal prefers.
Yeah, no, I agree with all that. I would hope that eventually Calipari will use him like that. But, just given what we saw last year with Towns, I don't know that will be the case. He even uses a talent like Alex Poitras inside, Poitras has a lot of perimeter skill that I think he hasn't really gotten a chance to show.
Davis, DeMarcus Cousins? Like, they didn't show what they could do offensively while they were at Kentucky. Now, it worked out. They won a whole bunch of games. He knows what he's doing. But typically, Cal doesn't want his bigs playing on the perimeter, and I think Scal is probably better, floating around, even though he's a legit 6'10", 6'11". Isaiah Briscoe's been good, too.
Briscoe's been really good defensively.
Yeah.
He's shut down Grayson Allen.
Right.
GP's got Kentucky in number one, top 25 and one, which makes sense. They're number two behind Carolina, and you drop Carolina down to 10. I liked the Maryland-Georgetown game was just so much fun, but are you thinking right now, again, super small sample size, but Kentucky to me has looked just really, really good, really fun. More fun than, it's funny, like, there are a few games this year. To me, they look more fun than the team that played last year, which was just almost, dominating in this just systematic way. But I don't know how much difference there is between Kentucky. You've got Maryland 2, Michigan State 3, and 1-1 Kansas number 4. But do we think Kentucky has kind of established itself as the clear-cut best team, almost a week and a half into the season?
I don't think clear-cut, but I think they're the best team right now. I mean, they looked, some of this is like the impression you make when on a big stage, and they looked awesome against Duke. They made Duke look very average. I don't think Duke is average, but they made Duke look average. We've seen what Grayson Allen did before the Kentucky game and after the Kentucky game, but in that Kentucky game, he was physically overwhelmed. And so, I'm not ready to put a championship banner in Rupp Arena, a new one yet, but they look like the best team.
Yeah, I'd agree with that. I think they're kind of in a tier by themselves right now, even ahead of Maryland. I mean, Maryland struggled with Ryder, struggled with Georgetown this weekend. So, I mean, Maryland's probably the team that's, got the closest ceiling to them, maybe. I'd probably say Kentucky number one by clear margin.
Okay. There have been a lot of weird. Go ahead, JP.
Well, like the other thing is, like, you know, Kentucky is basically 100% healthy, and some of these other teams are dealing with stuff, right? Like North Carolina, yeah, obviously is without Marcus Page. Greg Marsh,
Kansas doesn't have Diallo.
Kansas doesn't have Diallo. Wichita State is without Fred VanVleet, and Greg Marshall just texted me like right now. VanVleet's backup point guard definitely out this week too, with a stress reaction, and so, like, you know, it's basically, you know, all Ron Baker, like Ron Baker's having to do everything for them. So, like, some of this is, you know, I guess it's the same as in the NBA or any other sport. Like, being healthy is advantageous, and Kentucky is for the most part, you know, all of its key pieces are healthy.
It's been a weird start because we've had a lot of teams lose to teams they wouldn't. And some of these teams aren't necessarily even teams in the top 25. Like Virginia Tech dropping home game to a SWAC team, like just crazy. But there have been an abnormal amount, it seems to me. Georgetown, which actually has Georgetown's like the weirdest one of all, right? Because they're 1-3, but you gotta have, and they lost that weird opener to Radford at home in double overtime. They played Maryland really well. I watched them play Wisconsin Friday night. Like, came home from the hospital, that was the first game I watched. They looked terrific against Wisconsin. And then they play Duke close, but they're 1-3. So it's between teams losing weird games and then other teams like Georgetown playing. You know, they've had three straight games against NCAA tournament teams. I think there might be a couple of teams that people might be sort of low on, but I still maintain Georgetown as a top 30 quality team. The Radford game might have just been shake off the cobwebs, and Radford played really well and hit a big shot. But overall, I still think Georgetown is the second best team in the Big East right now. Maybe Butler's right there, though.
I would probably go Xavier as the second best team in the Big East right
Xavier's
now.
A good fit. That's a good point. I haven't seen them play that yet. So
yeah, they went up to Michigan and kind of really put it on Michigan. Trevon Blewett's really good. Jalen Reynolds is a monster inside. That dude's going to be an upgrade on Matt Stainbrook this year, and that's not necessarily a hard thing to do, I would say. They've been really, really good, but I think that Georgetown's gonna be fine. I mean, they're an NCAA tournament team.
Yeah, but like, Butler looked good until it played Miami. Xavier looked great at Michigan over the weekend. Villanova, we have no reason to think they're not, you know, really good again. They beat the East Tennessee State team by like 30 that ended up going and subsequently winning at Georgia Tech. So like, Villanova looks strong. I think it could be a four bid league, right? That, like, that's and Seton Hall got a win over Ole Miss, which isn't awful, you know. Like, that's I don't know how great it is, but it's you know, a neutral court win over Ole Miss yesterday. So I think the Big East could be looking at Villanova, Xavier, Butler, Georgetown. Like, that seems reasonable to me.
Yeah, maybe Providence too.
Yeah,
I mean, when you have Chris Dunn, you have a shot. I mean, they went to, or they had Illinois come to their place and they beat Illinois. They have a couple of interesting-ish games coming up. They have Evansville and Rhode Island within the next week and a half. So we'll learn a little bit more about them soon. But yeah, I'd say 4-5 in the Big East. And I mean, that wouldn't be too surprising.
Anything you guys looking forward to this week? Of course, the Maui Invitational, like, as we're recording, is like about to tip off. I think Vanderbilt's about to play. Who's Vanderbilt playing?
Yeah.
Wake or
St. John's?
St. John's, right?
That should be a big win.
Yeah.
I love the Maui tournament.
Love it.
I mean, I love the whole week. This is the pros and cons of this week. Is the pros are you're going to get a lot of good, interesting matchups just by nature of the tournaments and where teams end up playing each other. The weird thing is, like, I was watching the Puerto Rico tip off, and there's like nobody in the stands. Like, it's just so weird, and it's all money. It's TV. Like, we get it. It's just such a weird juxtaposition to the point where last night, chilling, hanging out with the boy, and I'm like super pumped to watch Stanford and St. Mary's, and I'm like, oh yeah, it's because it's an on-campus game, and like, this is the exception and not the rule, unfortunately. Wish we had more of them, but we get these interesting tournaments. I would say Maui's interesting. Sam, you're going to be at Wooden later on this week. Who's in that one?
Wooden has, I know, Michigan State, Providence, Boise State, UC Irvine, Boston College. There are a few other teams. I think Santa Clara and Arizona's in there too. I forgot about that. Arizona's the headline.
So that's the one that's the one we root for, is the Arizona Michigan State final.
Yes, right? I would say that's true.
The Wooden, that's in Anaheim, right?
It's in Fullerton, and then the final is in Anaheim, I think.
Okay. Yeah, I've been to that one before. I think I've been to that one twice. Typically this week, I always go to either Orlando or Anaheim, right? Because it's a great place to see, you know, eight teams all in one location. You know, when you have young children, if you pay to take the family along, it can turn into a nice little situation for them as well. You get the Saturday off because they can't put basketball on television on Saturday, for the most part.
Football inventory.
Because of football. So you get, they typically play Thursday, Friday, and then Sunday. And the event in Orlando is actually typically decently attended. But
yeah.
the one out in California, like, I just remember nobody being there. Like, absolutely nobody was in the stands. And it does make for a weird environment. Like, you could reasonably have two top 20 teams playing and nobody in the stands. I'm with you, Nolan. Yeah, I love the on-campus games. Like, that Georgetown, Maryland the other night. Give me great non-conference games on campus. Like, that is – it looks the best. It feels the best. That's the way to go, but as we know, television dictates a lot of this, and so here we are.
Yeah.
Given what I've seen at UCLA games so far this year, the attendance has been like 6,000. I would say I expect very little attendance.
How good was that Sean Miller press conference the other night?
Yeah, well, Sean Miller is great.
recap it for the listeners, because I think I read the story that you wrote, GP, like the day later. This is, first of all, it's Miller. Sean Miller is awesome, and he's one of those guys where I feel like the public doesn't really know Sean Miller as like who he is as a person, because he kind of plays it close to the vest. But for him to do what he did, I thought was unexpected and kind of amazing, and I wish more coaches had the guts to do it.
They beat whoever they beat. I don't even remember who it was, and it was like they beat him by 30. Bradley, I think it was, right? So they beat Bradley by 30, and. There's 14,000 people at the game, basically a sellout. And it was a Monday night game. I had just gotten to Chicago, and so I was just up. It was the night before the Champions Classic, and I was just up. And honestly, somebody on Twitter like tweeted at me and was like, "You got to check out Sean Miller's press conference tonight. It was fantastic." So I, quick Twitter search. There's a million Arizona beat writers out there. I knew I'd find it somewhere. So I found that from a student reporter, the transcript of it. And it was, just your normal sort of press conference where you're, opening statement and you start talking. And he said something along the lines of, I'm paraphrasing here, but this is the gist of it. And I will never take this crowd for granted. It was unbelievable. You know, 14th Monday night playing Bradley, still 14,000 people in this place. And, you know, I appreciate that. And I'll never take it for granted because, you know, I was sitting at home last night. You know, just watching some basketball, and I couldn't believe how many people weren't at the games. You know, he's like, now I know that the traffic's bad. I know the traffic's hard, but like, still, there's nobody there. Like, you almost think, like, did they put the wrong date on the tickets, and people don't even know the game's going on? And if you're a recruit, I don't know why you would ever want to go to a place where people don't go to the games. Like, it just doesn't make any sense to me. But, you know, but either way, I'm really appreciative of our crowd because we don't deal with that. 14,000 in here every night. We get, you know, sellouts for our scrimmages, and you have to pay to come to those too, and blah, 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 blah. And it was just very clearly a shot at UCLA, right? But first off, UCLA. First off, UCLA played the night before, all right? So that, and nobody was in Pauley Pavilion. And, the whole traffic thing, like, that's clearly a shot at LA. Not a shot at LA, but like, that is all, I don't want to say always, but it has been a well used excuse, often used excuse about attendance at, in Westwood is like, it takes so long to get there. And I, as somebody who has driven from, downtown LA to Westwood, it can take a long time to get there. I can testify to that. Arizona lost a commitment. TJ Leaf to UCLA. And so the last part of Miller's press conference where he's saying, I don't know why a recruit would want to go somewhere where nobody goes. That seemed like he still might not be over the TJ Leaf thing quite yet. It was just perfect. You know, Steve Spurrier has done that for years, like taking little subtle or not so subtle shots at rivals. We don't really get that too often in basketball. So to get it, I loved it. I thought it was terrific.
Yeah, anytime we can make college basketball more Steve Spurrier-like, I feel like we should embrace that.
For sure.
And just really lean into it and make sure it's reported really well.
But, well, Sam, you live there. Like, why do people in L.A. just – like, this has always been – the first time I ever went to Pauley Pavilion – now, this is before the renovation – two things struck me. because, like, from a distance, like, I grew up in North Mississippi. Pauley Pavilion is, like that is one of the places in college basketball, mm-hmm. right? And the first time I went there for a game, I was struck by two things. One, what a dump. Holy crap, it was terrible, right? Mm-hmm. Now, it's nice now.
Yeah, they renovated it. It's definitely better now.
It's pretty nice. Yeah. The problem is that sound doesn't carry well at all.
Right.
Whenever you're in the arena. As far as what UCLA's done for everything, they have new facilities coming reasonably soon, but the facilities right now aren't particularly great, like practice facilities and stuff like that. There's just a lot to do in Los Angeles, to be honest, right. And it's a very spread out city.
Right.
So you have to drive half an hour to get anywhere.
Right.
Yeah, I mean, we were there and at the game. I was at the Pepperdine UCLA game, and like you look around and it's not even like the student section. The student section is there. You would probably like to see more students there, but whatever. I mean, it's not terribly awful, but it's the fact that UCLA puts their like paying like season ticket holders that aren't students, like alumni, on the sides of the court. It just makes it look awful every right. time someone's going to take a picture. I mean, it's just really, really bad because those are the people that aren't coming to the games. The students, you get enough, but whenever there are people that are, you know, making $200,000 a year or whatever, who just plunk down a little bit of money for season tickets to UCLA and don't really care if they go to games or not, you really have to find a way to maybe switch where the students sit comparatively to where the season ticket holding alumni sit, because those guys aren't coming out to the games.
Yeah, like those were the two things that struck me. One, like Pauley Pavilion is a dump, and two, and not a dump anymore. It's great, but at the time, which is why they needed the renovation. And secondly, like nobody was there, and this was like a game. It's when I think Aaron Brooks was at Oregon, so they were good. Mm-hmm. And, UCLA was in that run of Final Fours. Like, you know, it was around that time. So, like, they were good. And nobody was there. Like, it just didn't matter. Like, it just did not matter. You couldn't get, you know, I don't even know if there were 6,000, 7,000, 8,000 people there. And it's always been interesting. Like, you would think, on one hand, there's so much to do in L.A., I got it. But also, like, there's so many people in L.A. Like, you don't need, yeah. So it's always been sort of an interesting dynamic. UCLA basketball, I think, looks better from a distance than it does up close. Because when you get up close, like, it doesn't seem to register in its local market, which is, even when it's operating at a high level, which is just, it's just interesting. It's always been interesting to me why it doesn't seem to matter there.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, it's always seemed like more. I mean, I've lived here for, I think, 3 years now, and it's just always seemed like more of a pro sports town to me right. than a college sports town, just because the way the city is it is so very like people move to Los Angeles and just bring their own fandoms as opposed to, you know, people staying in Los Angeles for their whole lives. It's a very transient city, I would say. I would say that there probably aren't as many UCLA alums throughout the city as you would think there are.
And so for people listening that are listening to this podcast today, we're recording it. Actually, UCLA, kind of circling back to what GP and we were talking about with the tournaments, quickly on Maui. So UCLA gets UNLV. That's the last game. Hey, buddy, it's okay. That's the last game on, listen, flawless right now. The last game Monday night.
How do you keep them quiet like that? I've had babies. Like they once they start screaming, they don't stop until mommy gets involved.
He's just hanging out, man. He's about due for a feeding in about 45 minutes, but he was due for a good nap, so he's just hanging. UNLV UCLA. That's the last game on Monday night. The big one for both programs, because one, UNLV can absolutely beat UCLA. That'll be pretty interesting within that. But overall, you've got Kansas and Indiana are the other two, and Vanderbilt's really good too. So Maui will be interesting to see who gets. One, who wins, and the Maui's always intriguing because it can be a situation where if you lose the game you shouldn't lose, then it hurts your resume because since Maui mm-hmm. has so many good teams, there's usually only one team, if it happens, that loses, and so then you get the non-NCAA tournament teams, and you don't get the chances for the victories down the road. Battle for Atlantis can be similar to that. That's the other, obviously, that's the big one. I just wanted to hit on that real quick since people are listening, and that's later in the week. So that starts Wednesday. It's probably the best tournament because top half of the bracket, you get Gonzaga, Washington, and you get Texas A&M, Texas. Okay, old school, no longer Big 12 matchup, but a throwback there. Three of those four teams can go to the NCAA tournament. Washington's been better this season so far than I expected, but we'll see. And then the bottom half is intriguing because you get UConn plays Michigan, which is fantastic. But if UConn wins and then Syracuse beats Charlotte, you get UConn Syracuse on Thanksgiving. You know, again, a throwback that's no longer a conference game, but an old school Big East matchup. So that could be pretty intriguing as well. Battle for Atlantis goes Wednesday to Friday. It's probably the best bracket overall between Gonzaga, A&M, Texas, Michigan, UConn. Make the argument for Syracuse, you know, more than half the bracket could get into the actual NCAA tournament. So that's the other, like, you know, Sam's got the Wooden Legacy, but clearly that's a huge one there.
Now the whole week's gonna be good. Like I'm with you. I like this week of basketball, and I like I said earlier, I usually go to one of these events, but I've got to be in New York on Saturday, so that means I have to fly there on Friday, which means it doesn't make any sense for me to go.
It's probably just a brutal day to travel, to be honest.
Oh, the day after Thanksgiving, huh? I didn't even think of that.
Maybe not. Maybe people take the whole weekend.
Yeah,
you'll have a travel report.
It'll be fine. But I'm not going to these events, which is fine with me because like I can sit back and watch it all on television. It's great television if you're a college basketball fan.
No doubt about it. The thing is this week it's one of those things where like when you're into the sport and you follow it like we do week by week, and I just love this week. I really do. I get that casual sports fans who probably wouldn't even listen to this podcast don't get so into it, but I'm telling you, like, these are pivotal matchups because when we get to mid-February, and I understand a lot of these power leagues will give opportunities, the non-conference has always and will always mean something to the selection committee. So It's when you can win these games and move on in these tournaments to play better teams, and if you're going to play them close, the committee is watching. They're paying a lot of attention. They are on neutral sites, you know, so that does, you know, for as bad as it might be at some sites with not-so-great crowds, they are true neutral court games. So they obviously mean something, and the outcomes from the next 5, 6, 7 days will have impacts on NCAA tournament inclusion and seed lines overall. It'll be intriguing. There are definitely going to be upsets to come, but I'm interested to see, because usually once we get past this week, you get your first like true impression. Like, we're still kind of just, you know, groping in the dark, so to speak, to see who's good. You know, are these weird losses aberrational to start the season? Once you have teams get, you know, 6, 7 games underneath them and they've beaten one or two really good teams, I think by the time we record next week, we'll just have a better grasp on, okay, you know, these guys are really showing up. They're really good. These guys, you know, what's kind of going on there, and so to speak.
Seriously, yeah. Actually, I wrote about Fred VanVleet's injury earlier today, and if you look at Wichita's schedule, they could be in some trouble if they lose this opening game to USC in the Advocare Invitational in Orlando or whatever it is, because then they'll probably get Alabama in the second game and then one of the lower bracketed teams, maybe a Monmouth or maybe a Dayton or an Iowa or something. So they could be looking at basically having no wins over NCAA tournament teams until they go to Utah on December 12th.
Utah goes to Wichita.
But if they don't win that Utah game and if they don't get the matchups they need in Orlando, they'd really be putting themselves behind the eight ball as far as creating a resume that the committee would actually look at as far as being a mid-major in a Missouri Valley that's just only okay this year.
That's the problem too, because you've got to get the wins. It doesn't matter how good we think you are. You've got to have the wins if you're from a league like the Missouri Valley. You know what it reminds me of? Steph's last year at Davidson. Everybody wanted Steph in the tournament again. They had gone to the Elite Eight before, and Steph was awesome. And we thought Davidson like might be good enough, like one of the teams that like good enough to get in the tournament again, and then, you know, just let Steph go. What? But they didn't have the wins. They didn't beat anybody. You couldn't put them in. You'd hate the idea that could maybe happened to Ron Baker and Fred VanVleet.
That is a great call. I forgot about that. I just brought it up because I remember they were good. They actually won. They won 27 that year. Steph was outrageous that year. Yeah.
He still is, by the way.
Oh, I know. And it's
still
great.
Decent at basketball.
I mean, to be honest, I I think it's absolutely awesome and amazing that a dude that went to Davidson is the best player in the NBA right now. I just think that's so awesome. But you could be right with that. Now the thing is, it will be remain to see how long do they not have Van Vliet, and it doesn't look like he's going to be available this week at all. So if they don't have him and they don't have their backup point guard for a certain number of games and they lose, it's still going to count against them. They don't, you know, just because you don't have your player and you lose, you don't get a free pass by any means. But if they come back strong with Van Vliet, sure. I don't know. We'll see. The committee does take injuries, as they should, into account. But the problem is, this is so early in the season. They're going to have so much more season after that that it would be different as if they had played, two wins, one loss or whatever with a healthy Van Vliet. Then they lost Van Vliet late February for three games, maybe went 1-2 there. I feel like they would get more of the benefit of the doubt in February than they will in November. So you're absolutely right. That's a good call, guys, just in terms of Wichita State. This is a pretty important week, because if they do win, beat USC, they could probably get Xavier and get a good chance there. Losing really puts them, as we mentioned before, with how Maui can kind of bite you. You lose opportunities, and that can really add up at the end of the year.
All right. Well, listen, Vanderbilt is beating the crap out of St. John's. It's 23-4, 8 minutes in. 23-4, 8 minutes in. So let's go watch that. Let you take care of your
Orlando. Before we do it, who will win by more? Vanderbilt against St. John's? Or who has Chaminade?
Kansas has Chaminade.
Kansas.
You think Kansas will be? Listen, okay.
I think Vanderbilt will beat St. John's right now by more.
What is the line on? Can I bring up the? I know we want to wrap up. Hold on, I'm going to bring up the line on the CBS Sports app on this Kansas Chaminade game. They have lines on against non D1 teams, right?
It gets iffy. It's 28. It looks like right now is the consensus. So Kansas is favored by 28.
Vanderbilt was only favored by like 14 or so.
Yeah, it was my pick in the viewer's guide this morning. It was 16.5, and I said Vanderbilt will cover. Yeah, that looks pretty good. I would say Vanderbilt will win by more.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. I'm saying Chaminade will keep it closer, because with the benefit of knowing it's 23-4 right now, I'll say Chaminade keeps it closer at the end of the game against Kansas than St. John's does against Vanderbilt.
Let's keep in mind, a Division II team beat St. John's by 30, all right? So, Vanderbilt might be able to get them by 30 as well. What a mess. All right. So we're going to do this again on Wednesday, I guess, right?
Is that the plan? What are we doing here?
I mean, are you going to bring on anyone else, or you just want to?
Here's the problem. I mean, we should probably talk about this off the air, but we'll talk about it here too. Everybody has a podcast now. I used to bring on I'd have Rob on 1 week, and then I'd have Nicole Auerbach on 1 week, and I'd have Pat Forty on 1 week, and whatever. But the problem now, everybody has their own podcast now. Nicole's got one. Rob's got one. So look.
I know a man mm-hmm. north of Boston who doesn't have a podcast.
That's sure, nobody. I'm nobody sure. wants to talk to him.
I'm sure he's dying to get on.
No, he really is. Like, text message me every other day. maybe I'll bring him on.
We can mix it up. But if you want to talk, at some point Wednesday, I can squeeze you in between changes. Hey, my boy did pretty good. First appearance on the podcast.
Unbelievable, Norlander. You're an amazing father already.
Doing my best, man.
You're a comforting presence for that little baby boy. So, in all seriousness, congratulations, man. Congratulations to you and your beautiful bride. And now try to get a nap in if you can too.
I am actually legit. I'm gonna try and get a nap in before we have the Maui Marathon later. So
dig it. Remember, you can subscribe to the Ion College Basketball Podcast over at iTunes. It's the quickest way to get your hands on the latest episodes. So go do that. And like I said, we're gonna talk again on Wednesday. Till then. Take care.